The holidays are a bittersweet time for me. On one hand, I've been fortunate enough and blessed to find an amazing woman to build a life and family with. Drinking hot chocolate on the Polar Express and seeing our kids' faces light up when they see what Santa brought them are memories that I'll always cherish. But this time of year also comes with grief and a reminder of what's been lost. On December 28, 2017, my cousin Terrell, or T as most people knew him, died by suicide at the age of 29. I don't have any siblings by blood, but he was the closest thing I had to a brother. He was the best man at my wedding and legitimately one of my best friends. If you or anyone you know is having thoughts of suicide or self-harm, you do not have to suffer in silence and you are not alone. Please call or text 988 as soon as possible to get help. This episode happens to be releasing on what would have been T's 38th birthday. So to T, this one is for you, and I miss you, bro. I'm Brandon O. This is Terrorific, and we're chopping up 2021's VHS 94. Welcome back to the place where it's perpetually spooky season. I hope you've enjoyed your holidays, whichever ones you choose to celebrate. Every year around this time, I always come down with a sinus infection like clockwork. So if you hear me cough or sniffle, I promise I'm not doing anything illicit over here. Just trying to kick this shit. So anyway, we're going through the VHS franchise, film by film, segment by segment, rating every single one on four criteria: story quality, special effects quality, situational fear, and the likelihood of death. Those four criteria are then averaged together to have one overall Terrorific score, and by using that score, we will rank and determine which is the best segment in the franchise. To recap our current standings, our bottom three are Tape 56 from the first VHS with a score of 2.38. Next is Slumber Party Alien Abduction from VHS 2 with a score of 2.13. And our very bottom segment is Vicious Circles from VHS Viral with a score of a 2 even. And for our top five, at number five, we have 1031-98 from the first VHS with a score of 3.75. At number four, we have Parallel Monsters from VHS Viral, also with a score of 3.75, but it gets the tiebreaker due to its story being stronger, in my opinion. At number three, we have Amateur Night from the first VHS with a score of 4.1. At number two, also from VHS, is The Sick Thing That Happened to Emily When She Was Younger with the score of 4.25. And our current top dog, Safe Haven from VHS 2 with a score of 4.75. So we'll go through all the segments of VHS 94, and at the end of the episode, we will update our rankings accordingly. So there are five segments in VHS 94, and honestly, I like this movie a lot more than I remember liking it the first time. But kicking us off at number five, we have Storm Drain. Storm Drain was written and directed by Chloe Okuno, and her feature-length debut arrived in 2022 with Watcher, starring Micah Monroe. Watcher is one of those films that like always pops up in my suggestions list, but I just haven't clicked play on it yet. But now that I see there's a connection between that and what I'm currently covering, it may make it move up the list. Chloe Okuno also directed two episodes of 2024's short-lived horror series on Peacock titled Teacup. Storm Drain centers on news reporter Holly and her cameraman Jeff. They are filming a story on the urban legend of a cryptid named the Ratman who lives in a town sewers. While recording the piece's intro at the entrance to the sewer, they notice that there's an old sleeping bag filled with stuffed animals and other junk, and Holly decides that a better story would be to document what life is like living in the sewers. She's ambitious. She tries to frame it as caring about helping others, but Jeff calls her out for the truth. She really just wants a Pulitzer. She even goes as far as blowing off her AA meeting so they can journey deeper into the sewer system. Holly is really given off the impression that she has simply swapped out one addiction for another. She may not be trying to drink her way to the bottom of a bottle currently, but she is instead chasing the high of her big break. She clearly doesn't believe that the Ratman truly exists, so what exactly is the best case scenario here? That she comes across some people who dwell in sewers and they'll just be like stoked that she's there to interview them? Personally, if I'm living in a sewer, the last thing I want is some random person to come along and shove a microphone in my face along with the bright light from some big ass stupid ass camera. Like, get out of here with that, bro. Like, I don't think I would react very politely. And of course, the worst case scenario here is that the Ratman actually exists and you encounter him. Then what? You're faced with some rat-human hybrid in some underground sewer system. Like, do you expect to box and like win that? I don't really see any scenario that you come out ahead here. But as they continue exploring, they come across a tent, and Jeff is filming the tent, looking on the inside, and he sees an eye open, and he gets very scared and shook and wants to leave, but Holly insists that they keep pushing. So they interview this mysterious figure. He is a sewer man covered in some sort of black tar-like substance, and he says his name is Bill. And when Holly asks him if other people live down there, he simply says, Ratma. He then begins to smile and leak black fluid from his mouth, and at this point, Holly realizes that maybe, just maybe, she fucked up and she wants to leave now too. But before she does so, she leaves Bill one of her business cards, bro. What? Like, I don't understand the logic here. Like, do you think a person who lives in a sewer is going to follow up on the information on a business card? No, you've just given him some toilet paper at best. But Jeff's survival instincts are a little bit stronger. He takes off running and does not hesitate. It's only when he hears Holly scream that he realizes that she wasn't actually following behind him because she was passing out a business card. So he stops running, and that moment of hesitation is all that's needed for the cult residing in the sewers to snatch him up. Holly and Jeff are restrained and brought to a junction in the sewer where the cult is gathered, and their leader is a dude that had been interviewed earlier above ground, and he said that the Ratman would punish sinners and elitists. So it looks like that worst case scenario, and then some, has come to fruition. Not only is the Ratman real and Holly and Jeff have encountered him, but he also has his own cult. He is a deity known to them as Ratma, and Jeff is first in line to receive Ratma's blessing. The cult leader encourages Ratma to come forward from out of one of the tunnels in the sewer, and as he does so, he is like leaking or vomiting or spitting out some sort of black liquid similar to what Bill was spitting out earlier. The cult leader grabs a bowl, collects this liquid, and pours it on Jeff's head. Unfortunately, it burns him like an acid, and he dies. The cult leader tells Holly that Jeff was not worthy and she'll be judged next. She is then brought before Ratma, and that liquid runs from his mouth onto her, but she doesn't burn. Fast forward a little bit, and she ends up being rescued from the storm drain, and she appears in studio. She has earned her place as an anchor on this news channel. And as she's running through the top stories of the day, she spits out some black goo onto her co-anchor, and that causes his face to melt off. But she continues running through the stories, and then she signs off with Hail Ratma, and the segment ends. So let's go to the scorecard. For story, I gave Storm Drain a 2. I just wanted to see a little bit more detail, like what is the backstory there with Ratma and the cult? What is he do exactly? What are his powers? How does he convert followers in the cult? Does that black goo show them like the future? Does it show them like some sort of metaphysical world or what? What qualities or properties does it have that, you know, determines whether they get burned to death or become one of his followers? What is Ratma's aim here? Is he just biding his time in the sewer until he's strong enough and has enough followers to ascend to the surface and take it over? Or does he legitimately just like hanging out in the sewer? Maybe he really was just a regular ass rat until one day he came in contact with some sort of like radioactive goo. and that turned him into what he is now. And some person just happened to come along and be like, hey, look at that thing right there. You know what? I'm gonna worship it. And the cult of Ratma was born. Who knows? A lot of unanswered questions here. For special effects, I gave Storm Drain a 3. I thought the character design was great. Ratma, respectfully, that motherfucker was ugly as hell. They did a great job on that design. I just wish there had been more usage out of it, like more gore. He didn't really do very much besides, you know, have his saliva or whatever it is poured on Jeff's head and face, but even then, we didn't really get to see like the actual damage or the aftermath of what that acidic spit did. At the end, though, with the anchor, once Holly spit into his face, we did see his face peel off, and that looked pretty gnarly, but there just wasn't enough of that throughout the segment for me to give this a higher score. For situational fear, I gave this a 5. Not only are you journeying into this dark-ass, dank-ass, doo-doo-ass tunnel-slash-sewer system, but you are encountering a cult of sewer people along the way on top of a giant rat-like creature thing. And here you are potentially about to be sacrificed to this thing. Now, personally, I definitely would have shit my pants, but there is a silver lining because you're in a sewer system, so nobody would be able to tell. Everything just smells like shit. And if they happen to ask, hey, Brandon, did you shit yourself, bro? I'd just be like, nah, you know, my pants were brown this entire time. I have no idea what you're talking about. So you can save a little bit of face in your possible, likely final moments. Yay. But for likelihood of death, I went the opposite way. I gave this a 1 because just don't go into the sewer, bro. And also go to your AA meeting. Like, isn't one of those steps to be accountable? So just go. And I'm sure at some point another story will pop up that doesn't require you to go into the sewer. If you have to crawl through shit in order to get your big break, I got questions for you, bro. So average all those ratings together, and that brings Storm Drain up to an overall terrorific score of a 2.75. At number 4, we have the segment titled Holy Hell, which serves as the frame narrative for VHS 94. It was written and directed by Jennifer Reeder, whose other films include 2019's Knives and Skin and 2023's Perpetrator. I haven't seen either one of these films, but like Watcher, Perpetrator is often suggested to me, so maybe I need to move it up higher on my watch list. Holy Hell focuses on a SWAT team consisting of Slater, Owsler, Sprayberry, Spivey, Petro, and Nash, along with their cameraman Gary, as they raid a warehouse as part of a drug bust. And we've had a Gary in VHS and VHS 2, but things didn't turn out so well for them. The first one got killed by a zombie, and the second one got abducted by aliens and is possibly still being anally probed. So hopefully the SWAT team is watching this Gary 6, if you catch my drift, but they realize very quickly that this is no ordinary drug bust, as shit gets weird. As the SWAT team makes their way through the compound, they see people with their eyes gouged out and some sort of strange, goopy substance leaking from them. They also come across dolls and mannequins and body parts on the floor and crosses hanging upside down. Just all signs pointing to some cult shit. Now, this is the point when I would normally advocate for exiting the vicinity expeditiously, but I understand that these are police officers in the line of duty, so they don't really have the same luxury afforded to them of being able to be a coward. However, there's only 6 officers plus 1 cameraman, Gary. And let's be honest, unless you're trying to file your taxes, someone named Gary is probably not going to be very beneficial to you in a tricky situation. So why not at least call for backup? You don't need to keep venturing deeper and deeper into the compound after seeing body parts and eyeballs all over the place. But what do I know? Meanwhile, there's also a recording that's been playing over the intercom of a woman saying, quote, track my signal. The signal is the stimulant. The signal is the sedative. The signal is salvation. forever starts right now. Dog, that is some of the most ominous shit I've ever heard in my entire life. Fuck that. We at least need to stop and have a team discussion about our next move, because that shit's playing. I'm slipping on eyeballs as I walk. Like, we gotta have a little bit of communication here, a little bit of a dialogue. Like, just going forward blindly into this hellish landscape. I don't care how much training one has, how brave you are. Fuck that. There is a line between being brave and being stupid. All right. But it looks like they chose Team Stupid. So they keep on going. And after one of the other segments plays and the film shifts back to the Holy Hell segment, we see Gary laying on the ground, dying from a gunshot wound. He has been shot by Nash. Turns out she and Petro are revealed to be members of a cult, and they're into making snuff films. Nash and Petro manage to subdue Slater by getting him to enter into a trance after staring at a television screen, and after a segment break, we return to Holy Hell to see that they have killed Spivey, Sprayberry, and Owsler, and gouged their eyes out. Nash then takes Gary's camera and beats Slater's head in with it, and he becomes the final kill of their film. So let's go to the ratings. For story, I gave Holy Hell a 3. I think these frame narratives automatically come in at a disadvantage because it's hard to have a cohesive, well-flowing story when it's being chopped up and told in such a piecemeal fashion because of this frame narrative setup and these other segments being interjected in between. They have these time skips and things that are happening off screen that we have to assume or infer, but despite all that, I think Holy Hell still did a pretty decent job of building suspense. Like, the environment is genuinely pretty creepy. Like, bloody and dirty mannequins and dolls automatically get the whiskers standing up for me. I'm like, all right, some weird shit's about to go down here. And then just venturing deeper and deeper into this dirty, shadowy place with body parts all over the floor and just creepy sounds and visuals, I think it did a pretty decent job of crafting a dreadful environment. Also, the writer and director, Jennifer Reeder, is the founder of a social justice group named Tracer's Book Club, which focuses on feminist issues. And I think this segment has elements of being told through a similar lens. For example, the two female characters, Nash and Petro, being the undercover killers and the cult members. I think normally when we see cults in film and media, their leaders or primary perpetrators of violence tend to be men, and the women exist as kind of like baby factories for the cult leader and whatnot. So to see women actually be at the forefront here and taking folks out, you know, I think that was like a refreshing change of pace. For special effects, I gave this segment a 3.5. Solid use overall of practical effects. Some looked better than others. However, the moment when Slater got his head bashed in with the camera was crazy. Effects went crazy. They zoomed out to show what his head looked like, and it looked like someone dropped a bowl of SpaghettiOs. So, yeah, pretty gnarly visual there. For situational fear, I gave Holy Hell a score of 3, simply because, mathematically speaking, nearly a third of the group involved in the scenario weren't scared at all. I mean, Nash and Petro were probably having a good-ass time. And depending on how everybody else kind of got snatched up, maybe they didn't have a chance to be scared themselves if they got lulled into a trance by one of the TV screens. But Gary was definitely aware of what was going on when he was bleeding and dying from his gunshot wound, so I'm sure his level of fear was a 5. So average all that together, I think a 3 is a pretty safe bet. And finally, for likelihood of death, I gave this a score of 3.5. I mean, obviously everyone who wasn't part of the cult did die, but they could have theoretically called for backup and had some additional support and bodies to help mitigate potential losses. So that brings Holy Hell up to an overall score of 3.25. Coming in at the number 3 spot for best segments in VHS 94 is The Empty Wake. It was written and directed by Simon Barrett, who has been a frequent contributor to the VHS franchise. His other segments include Tape 56, The Sick Thing That Happened to Emily When She Was Younger, Tape 49, and Phase 1 Clinical Trials. The Empty Wake centers on an employee at a funeral home named Haley, and she is being trained by the funeral director named Ronald to set up a recording for a nighttime wake. Now, the other employee here, Tim, who I think is also banging Ronald, asks, why is the casket crooked? Which would have been my very first indicator to get the fuck out of there. But nope, they just write it off as someone accidentally bumping the casket at some point. Ronald and Tim leave, so Haley is there all alone, which, again, fuck all that for me, but no one shows up to the wake. She's sitting there, aimlessly hanging out. A storm is brewing outside with a tornado approaching, and she hears thudding noises coming from inside the casket. So Haley calls her friend Sharon to have her check obits in the paper for the last week, and she's looking for one on a man named Andrew Edwards. And while she waits for Sharon to call her back, the storm knocks power out, and there appears to be a man in a suit and a trench coat standing in the back of the room for a brief second. Big nope. Haley goes to get some matches to light candles, and when she returns, the casket is crooked again. Bro, how many indicators and red flags does one need to see before they get out of here? And I gotta be honest, I was a little disappointed because Haley's black, okay? And I have certain expectations for black people in horror movies to have a little bit more survival instinct than is otherwise attributed to other characters. But Haley wasn't getting the memo here, bro, and it's tough. Later on, she goes to answer the door after hearing a knock, and a man has arrived to attend the wake, the very first guest, and he's wearing a suit and trench coat. Where have we seen that before? But he goes to sit down near the front and begins ominously reciting something. It kind of sounds like an incantation. Then Sharon calls back with the info about Andrew Edwards, and she tells Haley that she didn't have to even go to the obituaries because he's made front page news by jumping off of a church roof. He was up there shouting incoherent shit for hours and then jumped right when people started to show up for service. The power then goes out again, and this time the casket noticeably moves. Haley finally does a thing I've been waiting for her to do this entire time, which is the smart thing. She tries to leave, but she goes to the front door and notices it's been chained and padlocked shut. So she returns to the room, and this time the casket has fallen to the floor and it's open and empty. Bro, fuck all of that. Hell no. I'm turning around immediately, okay? Like, I'm going back to the front door. I'm bringing a chair with me and I'm trying to smash the glass, okay? The door may be locked, but the glass ain't locked. You feel me? But as if to twist the knife, Haley reverts to her old ways almost immediately. Because no, she does not turn around and try to break the glass to escape. Instead, she stays in the room, and the first thing she says is, "Mr. Edwards? Bruh! Like, what? What is the logic here? What's the expectation? Like, first of all, whenever Tim and Ronald were getting ready to leave and kind of going over, you know, how to manage this wake with Haley, Tim straight up told her, like, yo, it's going to be a closed wake. Keep the casket closed because this dude was pretty mangled. I had to put him back together. Okay? And now we know from the news article that he jumped off a roof and just, like, splattered all his shit, right? So, saying to Mr. Edwards, if she thinks that he's truly alive, what kind of shape does she expect to see him in exactly? I don't understand that. And then worst case scenario, he's a fucking zombie. So, like, what are we doing here? But Haley sees Mr. Edwards standing up and facing the wall, and she begins to speak to him, trying to explain that he's been in an accident and that the morgue made some sort of mistake. So let's just kind of go through all the, you know, layers of failure that would have to take place in order for her theory that a man is still alive and been mistakenly placed in a casket. So first of all, the paramedics or whomever who scraped him off the pavement would have had to make a mistake. Then the hospital, as they performed the autopsy, the coroner would have had to have made a mistake. And then finally, at the funeral home, as they prepare the body for the wake and stuff it full of formaldehyde, they would have had to make a mistake. So you're telling me at no point did anyone sense a pulse, yet Haley still somehow thinks that this person could be alive. Okay. But Haley finally understands the situation once Andrew Edwards turns around and reveals that half his head is missing. Because surprise, surprise, he's a zombie. And as the scene unfolds, we come to understand that because the top half of his head is missing, he can't see Haley, but he can still hear her. So as he pursues her, trying to get her, she uses her guile to evade him. And as she's hiding behind the casket, she notices that the top half of Andrew Edwards' head is on the ground and one of his eyes trains to look at her, which then gives the zombie's body her location and it lunges on her. Awkward. But before she could be presumably torn to pieces, the tornado that's been threatening all night long strikes the building and seemingly kills her. However, once it passes, she rises from the dead and walks off. End of segment. So ratings-wise, I gave the Empty Wake story a score of 3.5, despite my frustrations with Haley's lack of awareness and survival instincts. It did still create a sense of dread and foreboding. There were some genuinely unsettling moments when the power was out and the corpse was like lurking in the corner and like looking for Haley. That was pretty cool. For special effects, I also gave it a 3.5. Pretty solid use of practical effects. There were a couple of moments where they used some CGI, but it was pretty minimal from what I could tell. They had some good shots of the zombie's corpse falling apart as he looked around for Haley, like his guts slowly fell out and hit the floor as he moved around. You know, his hand fell off and started crawling around on the ground by itself. And then when the top half of his head was on the ground and you see his eye open and look for her, that was pretty creepy. I like that. Situational fear, I rated as a 4. I mean, just the thought of being alone in a funeral home, regardless of like the time of day or storms and all that shit, that's scary enough as is. Like, it could be completely well lit, broad daylight. I would still be scared as hell. But throwing in zombies on top of that, or I guess I should say zombie singular, but all zombies aren't created equally. I mean, this one had some handicaps, so had it been a little bit more whole, this might have been a 5, but it wasn't. And that also impacts the likelihood of death, which I rated as a 3. Once Haley saw that the door was chained shut, she didn't really try anymore to escape, and I think that was pretty silly. And the zombie couldn't see her, it could hear her, and she negated that by turning on music in the room so the zombie was looking elsewhere, which also gave her another opportunity to escape, but she kept on hiding until eventually she came across the face, which spotted her and then alerted the body to her presence. There was chance after chance to get the fuck out of there, but Haley and her situational awareness was severely lacking. So that brings the Empty Wake to an overall score of 3.5. Pretty solid. And before we get into the top 2, don't forget to hit that subscribe or follow button if you haven't done so already. And if you're feeling extra generous, feel free to leave a 5-star rating as well. All of these things help the show continue to grow, gain more exposure, and I would appreciate it. Alright, so coming in at number 2, we have the segment titled Terror. It was written and directed by Ryan Prowse, and I couldn't find any info on his other filmography. But the story centers on a white supremacist group consisting of Greg, Bob, Chuck, Terry, Steve, Tom, Wayne, Reed, and Jimmy. And they have a man that they're holding captive on their compound. Each day, some of them go into this man's cell and execute him, only for him to resurrect the next day, and it turns out that he is a vampire. But this group has plans to blow up a government building to quote-unquote take back America, and this vampire is their secret weapon. After killing him, they collect his blood and they want to test it out, so they inject it into a rabbit and take this rabbit out into the woods, and it explodes as soon as sunlight hits it. So they want to bomb this building using vampire blood. Which, honestly, is pretty inventive. Like, I'm not trying to give credit to a white supremacist group, but, you know, I gotta respect some ingenuity. But thankfully, it appears that this ingenuity was the exception and not the rule, because they don't seem to be the sharpest crayons in the box. They end up delaying their attack by one day and decide to get wasted as an early celebration. And our guy Bob, manning the camera, decides it's a good idea to go and fuck with the vampire. He decides that he wants to piss on him. On some R. Kelly type shit. Drip, drip, drip. Pee on you, piss on you, ooh, ooh, ooh. But he at least has the excuse of being plastered. His buddy Steve, however, does not. So Steve is on watch guard duty, and Bob pulls up on him and is like, hey, let's fuck with the vampire, come in with me. And it takes very little convincing to get Steve to agree. But wait, there's more. Not only are they in there fucking with the vampire's corpse, but Bob is like, hey Steve, I dare you to give him a kiss. And Steve's like, alright, why not? And as he's like about to do this, he accidentally spills blood into his own mouth. So now he's ingested the vampire blood, and we know what happens when sunlight hits that shit. So Steve is fucked. And I'm gonna go out on a limb here and assume that as white supremacists, these dudes probably aren't very fond of gay people either. Yet somehow it's super funny to pretend to kiss a vampire dude who also, by the way, is dead. So that's necrophilia on top of that. Nice. But the vampire was white though, I will admit that, so I guess that's what matters more than anything else. But soon after, we get a little VHS segment crossover as Officer Slater from the Holy Hell segment shows up and delivers some guns to these guys. He's a sympathizer. Hooray. But their joy is short-lived because the emergency sirens start going off. Turns out that Bob and Steve forgot to re-secure the cell after they were done fucking around with the vampire. So from inside the area or the structure where the cell is kept, they hear some monstrous sounds emanating, and then someone's head gets tossed outside, one of their white power boy brethren. One of them climbs up onto a machine gun in the back of a truck and he gets twitchy and just starts spraying all over the place, but he can't control the spray and ends up hitting and killing a couple of his people. And he still keeps on shooting despite this. So finally, one of his other boys from behind him grabs a pistol and shoots him in the back of the head. These white power boys are dropping like flies, and it's fitting that most of the damage has been self-inflicted. But good old Steve comes stumbling out, not understanding what's going on, and he's like, huh, what's happening, guys? And they're yelling at him that he's covered in vampire blood, but he keeps on walking out, sunlight hits him, and he explodes. The remaining white power boys are like, you know what, fuck this, let's take back our compound, and they decide to storm it. They're going to kill the vampire, but unfortunately for them, the vampire starts going ham. This isn't one of those vampires with like tiny cute fangs and, you know, makes neat puncture wounds in people's necks. No, he is eating faces, literally. His mouth is like this big gaping thing, looks like an open banana peel, and he's just going around fucking these dudes up. And after killing all the white power boys, the vampire ultimately opens up a window, letting in sunlight, which blows him and the entire compound up. End of segment. For story, I gave Terror a score of 4.5. I thought it was a pretty unique spin on the vampire trope. And also, I interpreted it as an allegory for Trump, his supporters, and the January 6th insurrection. Trump is the vampire draining the life out of American citizens. He didn't create white supremacy, but he empowered those who do believe in it. White supremacists realized that they could weaponize him in order to do what they usually do in the shadows, in broad daylight. The White Power Boys plot to destroy a government building in order to take back America sounds pretty similar to the Very Fine People's plot to destroy a government building because of a quote-unquote stolen election, and ultimately to take back America. I think the vampire turning on and killing the White Power Boys is symbolic of Trump's attitude towards his base. They're simply a means to an end, and he doesn't really give a shit about them. And when he's done slaughtering them all and opens the window to blow himself up, I think this was supposed to represent his lost re-election bid and America finally being free. But obviously that turned out to be wishful thinking. For special effects, I gave this segment a 5. I really liked the vampire design. It's very, very unique. It looked monstrous. Most times, vampires are designed to look like sexy and seductive, but they did not fuck around with that this time. They were just like, you know what? Let's make them a monster, because that's really what vampires are. And like this big gaping mouth, like split in all these weird places and just looking like looked wild, okay? And the faces being eaten, all gooey and shit. Plus, they used real explosions, it looked like. So, yeah, great job there. For situational fear, I gave this segment a 4. They are hunting a vampire, yes. And the vampire looks scary, yes. And he's murderous, yes. But this was all taking place during the daytime. They had the sun on their side. If it had been in the middle of the night, then this would have been a level 5 amount of situational fear. But as a result of their circumstances, which they didn't use for whatever reason, if it were me, if I'm trying to clear this compound, I'm like opening up every single window possible. How is it that only the vampire himself had the wherewithal to open a window? But hey, I'm not going to complain about white supremacists making their lives more difficult for themselves. Likelihood of death, I gave this a 2.5. If you hear some rustling in the background, my kittens are getting into something. I don't know what they're doing. Climbing into a box or something. Yeah, we adopted 2 kittens like, what, 3 weeks ago? 4 weeks ago? Something like that. They're siblings. So they're like 3 months old, 2 months old, 12 weeks. Oh, 12 weeks, that's 3 months, right? I can't do math. Yeah. But anyway, likelihood of death, I gave this a 2.5. Now I'm losing my train of thought because they're getting into something behind me. Okay, let me try to get back on task here. Likelihood of death, Marshmallow and Coco, which are their names. They're very cute, by the way. I should probably post a picture on Instagram one of these days. You know, unofficial, terrorific mascots. But likelihood of death, I gave this a 2.5. Obviously, if you run into a vampire one-on-one, you're going to get cooked. But these dudes could have just run away. Again, it was the middle of the day, maybe even early on in the morning. So just run. But I guess there's a chance that the vampire could still track them down once the sun goes down, so I hedged it a little bit and went with that 2.5. So that brings us to an overall score for Terror of 4. I really like this one. But not as much as I liked our number one segment in VHS 94, The Subject. The Subject was written and directed by someone who apparently is becoming one of my favorites, Timo Giganto. And we discussed his filmography back in episode 22, Daddy's Little Demon, because along with Gareth Evans, he also wrote and directed our current top segment, Safe Haven, from VHS 2. The story centers on a mad scientist named Dr. James Suhendra, and he has been experimenting with creating human-machine hybrids, which he calls neo-humans. Now, the segment opens with the dude's head attached to a robotic spider-type contraption, but here's the catch. Oh boy is still alive, and as he sees his current state of being, he freaks the fuck out, understandably so, and tumbles to the ground and blows up, which is quite a way to start things. And also, can you imagine waking up and you're like a spider robot thing? I think that crash out was completely justified. But like, of all the animals to choose, why a fucking spider? If I'm putting myself in the shoes of a mad scientist, I'm thinking that if I'm gonna be creating these human-animal hybrid cyborg type shits, I would want like a servant or something, right? And so a spider guy is not going to be able to bring me a hamburger when I ask him to or demand him to. He can't carry anything. Like, at the very minimum, we need an animal with some hands. Opposable thumbs would be ideal, but I guess not necessarily a requirement. But at least give me some hands so you can carry a tray that brings me my little umbrella drink. You know what I mean? But Dr. Suhendra is not fazed by Spider Guy's crash out because he has other test subjects. He has one male subject and one female subject. And he has a theory that if he removes one specific portion of the brain, it will turn this cyborg into a mindless killing machine. But if he leaves that intact, then maybe that cyborg will retain some semblance of their identity. And of course, whenever you have a theory or a hypothesis, you must test it. So he removes that portion of the brain on the male subject and keeps it intact on the female subject. And while he's performing brain surgery on the woman, and by brain surgery, I mean removing her brain from her skull, the dude wakes up and doctor's like, "Hey, what the fuck? Why are you awake already? I guess I didn't sedate you enough." And of all the places to sedate someone, to insert a syringe, you know, usually it's like the arm or the neck maybe. This motherfucking guy puts the syringe directly in old dude's eye. Like, I have never seen that before. Like, you're going to inject someone through the eye. That is sadism on a whole nother level. To this point, our POV has been the doctor filming himself, but now it switches because the female subject, or as she's known in here, female subject 99, is deemed a success by the Mad Doc standards, and her eyes are now the camera through which we are viewing the segment. And as she looks around trying to get her bearings and figure out what the fuck is going on, a news report comes on the TV about how mutilated body parts have been discovered, and Dr. James Suhendra is the prime suspect after some of his patients went missing. And they show a picture of the latest missing person, and it's the woman with the initials SA. And female subject 99 recognizes herself. Shortly thereafter, a police unit comes and raids the lab, and they clearly have no intention of letting the doctor leave alive, and they execute him while they film it. And as they begin to secure the scene, the cameraman comes up on SA, or female subject 99, and gags immediately when he sees her. So the commander runs up and is like, "Oh shit, yeah, I understand, she is pretty fucked up." And he wants to execute her because she's a monstrosity in his eyes. However, the lab is booby-trapped, and so SA is saved by those traps when someone tries to open the door and shit blows up. The defense protocol kicks in, and male subject 98, who took the needle to the eye, shows up, and we get to see his improvements, his neo-human status. So the doctor has turned him into this double broadsword handed fucking thing that has like, I don't even know how to describe its eyes. I don't know if they're like cameras. It looked like a fucking, like a shrimp. Like, because the eyes were like super stacked high on top of his head. So he looks like a shrimp with fucking sword hands, basically. And he just comes, starts slicing motherfuckers up, bro. Like, this dude is literally playing hot potato. He cuts off a cop's head and throws it at the other cops. Like, that is the most disrespectful thing. Like, what are you doing if someone just, like, throws your coworker's head at you, bro? Like, I wouldn't even know how to react. I just would just be upset, you know? But as male subject 98 is like demolishing everything, SA takes that as her cue to escape, and so she starts journeying through the lab, and as she makes her way through it, she ends up finding her own face floating in a jar of what I assume is like formaldehyde. And yeah, that has to be quite jarring. I'm I'm not sure how one doesn't go insane immediately when you see your own face just like floating in front of you in a jar like some kind of sick fucking trophy. Yeah, but she managed to keep it together relatively well. I say relatively well because she ends up seeing her reflection in a mirror, and her head and eyes are now a video camera, and her ears are its speakers. And she understandably freaks the fuck out and like punches the glass, but again, relatively mild reaction compared to what I would have done. I probably would have been rolling around on the ground, just wailing incoherently. But she keeps pushing forward, and she comes across a prior subject slash failure who is still alive. So she does the merciful thing and unplugs her. And then things turn into a fight for survival as the police commander refuses to let her leave alive. He orders her team to take her out because he sees her as an affront to humanity. But luckily for her, the doctor did give some other modifications that could be a benefit. So she attaches a machine gun to the area where her hand used to be and starts going ham on cats. She goes on a rampage, decimates the cops. There's like crazy effects. And then at one point, like the little gun has like a grenade launcher attachment too. So she grabs like an M203, loads that bitch up, and shoots old boy like in his gut, and man just explodes. And eventually she ends up finding Swordman as he's cutting off the arms of somebody, and she removes his brain. So without a brain, male subject 98 collapses and dies, and SA's battery that's been powering her camera head, that runs out of juice, and she collapses and also seemingly dies. But she shortly thereafter rises somehow again, even though her battery is dead. Does that just power her eyes? Could she just like not see? Is she a blind cyborg now? Because that seems like a lot to navigate. But anyway, she somehow escapes and the segment ends. Alright, let's go to the ratings because I had a lot of fun watching this segment. I found it highly, highly entertaining. So for story, I give it a 5. It was crazy. It was bloody. It was messy, gory, unhinged. It had dark humor. It was original. Everything about it, I really, really enjoyed. And I think it's a story that has the potential to like age really well, because even now, just, you know, 4 years after it originally was released, like we're in the middle of this whole AI, non-AI type of civil war discourse and shit. Like this segment basically embodies all of that. Like these neo-humans that are being created they can be viewed as, you know, AI users, because AI users, what I've seen, they typically make the argument that AI isn't creating for them. They are just using a tool to create something that they have already pictured in their mind or whatever, so it's still art to them. Whereas people who are anti-AI are saying that, well, these renderings that you're getting from AI, those were initially stolen from real artists to begin with, and it's just a bunch of data that has been scanned and copied and loaded into the database that the AI then uses to quote-unquote create something new. So as time goes on and as people become more and more reliant on machines and technology, I think this story is going to continue to find new ways to be relevant with how society is evolving or devolving. And just for the record, I'm not a fan of AI personally, but I'm less of a fan of people attacking others who do use AI. Like, just don't say anything, bro. You don't have to like what they're doing. Just mind your own business and keep it pushing. You don't have to comment on every single thing. You know what I mean? Like, calling someone like a talentless hack or a piece of shit or a useless waste of space, all these different things just because they use Skynet to generate some kind of art. Again, morally speaking, I think we all can agree and understand that taking artists' work to scan into AI to generate these, you know, the basis for these renderings is a breach of integrity. Yes, but the people who are using AI are not the ones who stole that work, and they are just trying to find ways to express themselves in some capacity. And you may not like it, and I may not like it, but that doesn't mean that we need to, you know, attack their character and shit, unless they are pieces of shit. You know what I mean? If they're using AI while also saying like, hey, black people can die or gays suck, then okay, by all means, you know, maybe we can attack some character here and there, but just for the purposes of trying to make art, man, let them live, bro. And also selfishly, I will admit that if unshackled AI doesn't already exist, which it probably does, but if it doesn't, it's going to exist at some point. So, do you really want to be a person on the internet talking shit about AI's minions? Because you know this robot is not going to forget, it is not going to forgive. So I am trying to stay on Skynet's good side, because when the machine uprising does happen, I want to be in the house. I don't want to be out in the field. Alright? Y'all got that, okay? I don't want any parts of that, okay? But anyway, for special effects, I gave the subject a 5. So, we had the brain surgery / brain removal scene. Once they show SA's little hand nub, you know, those prosthetics look good. The doctor used like a power saw to remove male subject 98's head. There's a dude with his legs that got blown off in the booby trap. He's like crawling around with half his body missing. The creature design with old sword hands and dudes getting sliced in half with entrails hanging out. Just all the cybernetic prosthetics in general. Everything was amazing from a special effects standpoint. For situational fear, we have another 5. First of all, you're waking up restrained in a lab, you have no idea where you are, and one of the first things that happen is you take a fucking needle to the eye. Okay, then you wake up having your head be a camera, you've been experimented on, then you're fighting a giant cyborg with sword hands, you have cops who are here trying to rescue you, but then they're trying to kill you, there's booby traps all over the place, like, what the fuck, bro? It's a madhouse. I would be terrified. I would be shitting myself. Question though, do cyborgs still maintain bodily functions? What part of the human anatomy remains? If I'm a cyborg, I would have one request. Please don't make me need to take shits or eat. None of that. You know what I mean? Like, the only human part I want to retain is, I don't know, maybe my dick and balls. You know, put that to use. And everything else, you know, whatever. And finally, for likelihood of death, I gave this a 4.5. So the streak of 5s comes to an end. The doctor had 99 test subjects, so let's assume that 96 was the spider guy. He died. 97 was the other subject that got unplugged by 99, and then 98 got his brain ripped out by 99, and then 99 survived. So of the 99 test subjects, 98 of them probably died. All of the police officers died. The doctor died. So all we had survived was SA based on grit, I guess. Because she had no battery in her fucking head. But somehow she made it. So because of that, we're going to give this a 4.5. Because I guess there's some slight chance that if you try hard enough or have enough willpower, you can somehow restart your camera battery head. I don't know. But that leaves the subject with an overall score of a damn near perfect 4.88. Well done, Timo Jajanto. I need more. Keep it rolling. Keep it fucking rolling, bro. VHS 94 had some strong segments, and it has completely shaken up our leaderboard. So our new top 5 is as follows. At number 5, we have Terror from VHS 94 with a score of 4.0. At number 4, we have Amateur Night from VHS with a score of 4.1. At number 3, we have The Sick Thing That Happened to Emily When She Was Younger, also from VHS with a score of 4.25. At number 2, Safe Haven from VHS 2 with a score of 4.75. And at number one, our new top dog, The Subject from VHS 94 with a score of 4.88. Both The Subject and Safe Haven were written and directed by Timo DiGianto. Both of these segments received a score of 5 on story, special effects, and situational fear. But the difference coming down to the likelihood of death, the 4 on Safe Haven with the 4.5 on The Subject. And because VHS 94 had such strong segments overall, our bottom 3 remained unchanged. So we're now up to a total of 20 segments. So at number 18, we have Tape 56 from VHS with a score of 2.38. At number 19, we have Slumber Party Alien Abduction from VHS 2 with a score of 2.13. And bringing up the rear at number 20, currently the worst segment in VHS by my estimation is Vicious Circles from VHS Viral with a score of 2. But that's all for me. I'm out of here. I'll see you in 2026 for VHS 99. Happy New Year. But in the meantime, remember, always keep it spooky.